I suppose it could be said that just about every age has its buzzwords, its sort of unique things that are almost too sacred to question almost. Here's one of them in this age, tolerance. Whatever you do, you gotta be tolerant, right? Well, what exactly do you mean by tolerant? That's what we're talking about this half hour on Issues Etc. Hi, I'm Ken Sherb for the vacationing Todd Wilkin, and as we made amply clear last half hour, we are live on this January 23rd. Our telephone numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. By the way, Todd is back behind the microphone this coming Thursday. Our guest on the other end of the phone line right now is Greg Kokol from California, the founder and president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. Greg's written an article on tolerance for the latest issue of the Solid Ground newsletter. Greg, once again, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello, Ken. It's nice to talk to you.
I think you get on this program more often than I do.
I think so. We've had a regular gig now for about 5 years or maybe longer, but I always enjoy talking with you.
Well, it's been about that long since I've seen you, so it's good to talk to you. What is this whole bit about tolerance, and what is it that you call the tolerance trick?
Well, I like the way you introduced this segment, because tolerance is this sacred thing, and it trades on, it's what I call a connotation word. A connotation word is a word that has a certain feeling attached to it, like kindness and goodness and mercy, and tolerance is one of those words. That is, when we hear the word tolerance, we realize we want to be that. That's a good thing to be. The problem is, in the last, I'd say, 20 years, that word has undergone a transformation. And in the transformation, it's radically changed its practical definition, the way it actually works its way out in society, but it keeps with it its good connotation. And I'm convinced that the concept of tolerance has been flipped on its head, as it were. It's almost been reversed. So what used to be known as tolerance is now, or I should say, what currently is being practiced as tolerance, what used to be called intolerance. But even though the definition has shifted, the word still sounds like a good thing. And this is the kind of tolerance trick. When Christians, for example, the classic example of this, of Christians running into this problem, Ken, is when we promote the gospel of Jesus Christ, and we say that Christianity is true. In other words, Jesus is the Savior for mankind. This isn't our little fantasy trip. It isn't the little kind of spiritual drug we're taking to make us feel better. We think this statement reflects reality. Now, the minute we do this, of course, when we say that Christianity is true in that sense, then we are saying at the same time, by force of common sense, that all the views that disagree with this have to be false.
Could I put in just a little footnote question here?
Sure.
It seems to me that perhaps these days you don't even have to make explicit that second statement, that the other competing gods are false and vain and idols. People kind of draw that conclusion, and they already hit you with the thing about tolerance just for saying that Christianity is true.
No, that's right. They figure it out. And in fact, even if you're not nowadays, especially on college campuses, there's been a number of cases where Christians are simply advancing Christianity in some way, not even making the claim that Christianity is true, but offering Christ. So they've really toned down the approach, and the argument is that even in so doing, they are implicitly claiming that Jesus is the only way, and therefore implicitly claiming that all these others are wrong. And this is where the tolerance trick comes in, and when you say that other views are wrong, you are violating the postmodern dictates of tolerance. Now, why is that a trick? Well, the trick is, when you think about, you look in the dictionary and you read what tolerance is, there's a couple of elements that are essential to it. That is the classical sense of tolerance. One of them is that you have to permit or allow, tolerate, conduct or a point of view that one, and here's the key, disagrees with. And you do it with grace and respecting the other person in the process. Now, this thing about disagreement is really essential, because if you don't disagree with a person, in other words, if you don't think a person is wrong, then you can't actually tolerate them in the classical sense. I ask people sometimes, do you tolerate homosexuality? They say, yes, I do. I said, well, then you think it's wrong, and you put up with it in a sense. No, I don't think it's wrong at all. I think it's fine. And then my response is, then you don't tolerate it.
You agree with it.
Exactly. You agree with it. And so in order to tolerate something, you got to say it's wrong. But nowadays, if you say it's wrong, that is, in their view, an example of intolerance. So true tolerance can never really be respected. And the trick comes full circle here. When people realize this, that nobody is neutral. You see, tolerance now kind of demands neutrality, right? This is like, well, your view is right for you, somebody else's view is right for them, and we all have to have this tolerant view that everybody is just as right for them, and we don't claim any superiority.
I don't know, Greg, I think you're being pretty intolerant, saying my view is right for me.
Yeah, well, see, the problem is even that view, this pluralistic view, is a view that those who are promoting it think is the correct view. Simply put, the so-called tolerance crowd, even by their own definition, is deeply intolerant towards the Christian's view.
Well, they've got a view they think is right, and they think that people who disagree with that view are wrong.
Yeah, this happens all the time. I'll tell you how you can expose this trick, and I use it frequently. In fact, I did a TV debate for an hour on national TV with Deepak Chopra, who's the number one New Age guru in the world. And Deepak Chopra, was on TV with me when we were doing this debate, and the same thing came up. Whenever anybody called, and he was playing the same game, I'm the intolerant one because I'm the Christian. He's open to everybody, except me, of course, and so he is the tolerant one. So when people call me intolerant, here's the question that I always ask, and your listeners should ask too. What do you mean by that? What do you mean I'm intolerant? Force them to give a definition, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, consistently, when I ask that question of people, here's what they say. Well, you're intolerant because you think you're right and everybody else is wrong. That's intolerant. And so my response is, well, I do think I'm right. I have reasons. I'm not just emoting about this. I could be mistaken even, but I have the courage of my convictions. But let me ask you a question. And this is the second step of exposing this trick. First, I ask them why they think I'm intolerant. They say, you think you're right. And so my second question is, now the views that you have opposite mine, do you think your views are right or do you think your views are wrong? Now, nobody has beliefs that they think are wrong. The reason they believe what they do is because they think they're correct in their beliefs. So, of course, they think their views are right. And this is where my third question comes in. Why is it when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant or arrogant or narrow-minded, you know, add your words. But when you think you're right, you're just right. How come the same standard doesn't apply to you that applies to me here?
What kinds of answers have you gotten when you've raised that question?
Well, what's important here is that it's not a rhetorical question, so I want an answer from the other person. I want them to explain it to me because I want to see that they're just playing a game here and they're just calling names. But, you know, the irony is some people have actually answered me this way. They said, well, the reason that when you think you're right, you're intolerant, and when I think I'm right, I'm not intolerant, is because I'm actually right. I mean, oh, man. And they say this with a straight face. Now, people don't realize they're making this mistake. That is, that they're calling Christians intolerant for thinking they're right, when, in fact, the person who's raising the issue also thinks they're right. It's just what the culture has given them the freedom to do, permission to do in this tolerance trick. And this is why it's important to graciously but directly unwrap this for them to help them to see that this is just a name-calling game that they're playing. They want to silence the Christian by calling him intolerant instead of dealing with his ideas. And that's the trick. That's the shell game that's going on.
505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Have you ever had somebody pull the tolerance trick on you? We're talking about it with Greg Kokel this afternoon on Issues, Etc. Greg, it seems to me that one of the things that will probably occur to people sooner or later is that nobody can live like this.
Well, the irony is, you'd like to think that it would occur to people, but it just doesn't. And unless some fair-minded Christian takes the time to point it out, they actually don't see the mistake that they're making. they think their view is open-minded, gracious, and fair, and accepting, and they think the Christians are these terribly bigoted, narrow-minded people. Sometimes the question comes to me, why is it that you guys are so arrogant and narrow-minded and intolerant? And my response is, well, to a great degree, it's because of the way you've defined the terms.
Mm-hmm.
And if I apply my terms to them, I'm sorry, their definitions in the same way to them, then they turn out to be intolerant as well. Let me give you an illustration if we have time. I don't know how soon the break comes up. But
actually, we don't have a break for a while, so
okay,
you've got
great.
Plenty of time.
This, let me tell you how this played out in a classroom in Des Moines, Iowa, not too far from where you guys are at, compared to me on the West Coast. And
the typical West Coast view of the world. We think that Des Moines is pretty far away.
Okay. Anyway, I was talking to a group of high schoolers there, seniors, in a Christian high school. It was a religion class, in fact. And I wanted to talk to them about this issue of tolerance. So we got the idea on the board, and we got a definition on the board. And the definition of tolerance is that all views are equally valid. In other words, if you think your view is better than somebody else, especially in the area of religion and morality, well, then you're the bad guy, you know. You're the intolerant one. Okay, so we got that on the board. All views are equally valid. Then I wrote another sentence on the board, and here's what it was. I wrote, Jesus is the Messiah, and Jews who reject him are wrong. Well, you know, them's fighting words, you know, in today's culture. And in fact, even in this Christian class, the kids got animated. They came alive, you know, and this one gal is raising her hands, waving it in my face, saying, hey, you can't say that. That's intolerant. And then she added this, how would you like it if somebody told you you were wrong? Now, you think about that for a moment, Ken. You mean like you're doing to me right now?
Yeah, I was going
to
say,
said.
The person telling you you're wrong?
Yeah, there it is. I mean, she had no idea she was making the same mistake. And I said, well, it doesn't bother me at all. Why should it? Why should I get upset just because somebody thinks I'm mistaken? Now, people nowadays think that they have a right to get mad if you disagree with them on these issues. But in any event, I played this out further. I said, let me ask you a question, because we've got these two statements on the board, and the students are very upset about my second statement. I said, this definition of tolerance, all views are equally valid, is that a view? They thought, well, yeah, I guess it is. Sure. That all views are equally valid is a view itself, all right? Now, what about the statement underneath it? Jesus is the Messiah, and Jews who reject him are wrong. Is that a view? And they thought about it for a while and screwed up their faces and scratched their heads, and finally they figured it out. Yeah, that's also a view. I said, well, that's kind of odd, isn't it? Tolerance requires that all views are equally valid, and the view, or rather the statement that Jesus is the Messiah and Jews are wrong for rejecting him, is a view. Therefore, on your understanding of what tolerance means, what do we have to say about the second sentence? We've got to say that it is just as good as any other view if we're going to be tolerant. And if you object to my statement about Jews needing Jesus, then you, by your own definition, are what?
Intolerant.
Exactly.
Well, this is the whole point when I say people can't live this way.
That's
if
right.
All views are equally valid, I don't know anybody who thinks that somebody's view of the law that would allow them to break in and steal stuff from my house is a valid view.
Yeah. Well, you're on to something here, Ken. And to be honest with you, this is the thing that's in the back of my mind all the time when I'm trying to play these things out in conversation with people. They actually don't believe this deep down inside. They don't believe that all views are equally valid, but they do believe that when it comes to religion and morality, particularly Christian religion and Christian particulars in morality, the politically correct issues, in specifically homosexuality, abortion, those kinds of things, well, then you have no right to act as though, excuse me, your view is better than others, or they're going to drop the load on your head. You know, they're going to call you names and give you a hard time.
Okay,
and,
now how do we get to that point? How do we get to that point where we have sequestered in a sort of a category by itself, religion and morality? It's okay to have exacting standards if you're talking about architecture, auto repair, or any number of other things. But now all of a sudden, religion and morality, all views have to be valid.
Well, there's a reason for this, and it takes more than 10 or 15 minutes to play it out, but I'll tell you simply that for postmodern people, modern people too, in this particular area, is that you can have some knowledge in the area of science. I mean, that might be possible because that's real knowledge. But when it comes to morality and it comes to religious questions, you can't put that in a test tube, and therefore you're never justified in saying that you know those things. When it comes to religion and morality, it's all guesswork, it's all personal opinion, it's all belief, and I'm putting that in scare quotes there. It's just a matter of the individual, and when Christians start acting as if they know a few things when it comes to religion and morality, that's what gets people ticked off.
Greg, you have this article in the latest issue of the Solid Ground newsletter in which you quote yourself, you quote a letter that you wrote to the editor, of a newspaper, and I really thought that the approach you took was kind of fascinating because you started off, I think probably deliberately, trying to sound like somebody who is on the politically correct tolerance bandwagon.
Yeah, there was in our local community here in Southern California, beach community there in the South Bay area, we call it, there was a lot of banter about homosexuality in the local paper and the letters to the editor and stuff, and the Christians who were more conservative in their views of this issue were being assailed by homosexual activist types, you know, for their narrow-minded, arrogant approach. So I wrote a letter that, as you put it, kind of started out sounding like I was one of these, you know, activist types playing the tolerance card, but I was playing it against them. And I was pointing out how inconsistent and intolerant the South Bay residents were to moral views other than their own. And then I cited these letters on homosexuality as cases in point. And then I referred to the narrow-mindedness and self-righteous attitude about sexual ethics that was hypocritical. Now, as readers are following along, they'll probably think I'm referring to the Christians. But as I continued in the letter, it became very clear that I was actually referring to the people who were objecting to the Christians, who were not able to apply the ethic they were advancing of kindness and open-mindedness and tolerance to those people who they disagreed with on homosexuality. And it's so ironic when you see in the public discussion, Ken, when some of these issues come up, the people that are angriest, nastiest, and meanest in the public setting, in other words, demonstrably, they're acting this way, are the ones that are allegedly championing love, kindness, openness, and tolerance. And this is what I was kind of trying to capitalize on in the letter.
Probably these kinds of issues, as they are joined and the tolerance card is played, happens more prominently and certainly in the media, like your local newspaper, in reference to issues of morality, homosexuality, abortion, we think about today, whatever it may be. But I think the bottom line is exactly where you started, and I was glad you started here. This is an important point we need to make on the way to proclaiming the gospel of Christ to people.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit more.
Well, Francis Schaeffer used to talk about pre-evangelism, and it used to be that, you know, you could start talking about Jesus, and you kind of had an audience that understood the meanings of the words, and you were playing by the same sets of kind of intellectual rules, the way everybody understood how this stuff worked and how to make a case and how to argue your points. Everybody agreed. Now the landscape has changed so dramatically that you can't even begin talking about the merits of Christianity because something else gets in the way. It's this politically correct attitude of distorted sense of tolerance. And so what we have to do is do, as I mentioned, what Schaeffer called is pre-evangelism. We have to kind of clear the brush. We have to get the stumbling blocks out of the way. We've got to define the terms of conversation even to get a hearing on our message. And sometimes that takes 90% of our effort. And it stands to reason this is what we do. We try to help to train people, and this newsletter is an example of that, on how they can maneuver through the minefields to even begin to voice the content of the gospel. And sometimes that can be a wearying enterprise, Ken, but it's part of being a faithful ambassador to do that. And this tolerance one is one of the biggest roadblocks. You just can't get a hearing if people can succeed in characterizing the Christian as intolerant for the views that he has.
Well, wearying and yet absolutely worth it, because when God became man for the salvation of men, that already kind of implies universality, and it implies that this is the answer. The other answers you may think you have are not right.
That's right. You can't, anybody who goes to the scriptures and listens to what Jesus says and the apostle says, they cannot walk away from them and cast Jesus and the Bible and Christianity in pluralistic terms, because Jesus wasn't a pluralist. He didn't believe that all religions lead to God. The first commandment, for goodness sake, prohibits following other gods and demands fidelity to the true God. Now, it may be the case that Christianity is wrong for the sake of discussion, but let's not mistake what it says. And one of the deep frustrations to me, Ken, is the fact that many people who claim to be Christians, and maybe even are so hounded by this tolerance trick that they want to relativize the gospel so as not to be called names. And in such, they are not being faithful to the message that Jesus entrusted his disciples with, and then by application, the rest of the church, including you and I. This is something we have to stand on, and we have to stand on it without budging, and learn how to parry these challenges that others have offered, but still not abandon the truth of the gospel. Jesus isn't just my way. He's either the way or he's not any way at all.
Well, let me put you a little case here in about a minute. Here's the issues, et cetera, challenge question for you, Greg. It'll be our last question here, too, in the interview. Talk about Acts 17, Paul at Athens, as an example of true tolerance.
Well here he was. It's a great, people should read it because it's a great test case. He goes in there and he tries to put himself in the intellectual shoes, as it were, of the people that he's speaking to. He starts speaking their language. He starts from their ideas. But as he starts there, he then disabuses them of their false ideas. He says, there's a statue to an unknown God. You're very religious. You even have a statue to a God you don't know about. Well, good for you. Let me tell you something about that God. Let me proclaim to you the truth about this God. And then he starts to introduce Jesus. And then he's very pointed, that there is a man that God, that unknown God, has appointed as will be a judge of all people in the end times, and he has proven this by raising him from the dead. And so he starts from the general, from where they're at, but he is bold enough to take that and move graciously right to the real gospel, and he never gives the short shrift on the real gospel. In fact, it got him in trouble. But it's a good example of speaking the truth in love in a way that's culturally relevant.
Greg Kokel, thank you very much. If you folks at home would like more from Greg, you can check out the website for Stand to Reason by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the section titled Links, you find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or if you want to receive the free Solid Ground newsletter, you can call Stand to Reason. Their number is 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Greg, it's a pleasure as always. Thank you very much for being with us this afternoon.
Thanks, Ken. I look forward to next time.
All right. Greg Kokel from Signal Hill, California. Next half hour, we're going to continue with the discussion of Paul. See, I brought up Paul for more reasons than one. This coming week, we've got the Festival of the Conversion of St. Paul in the church calendar, January 25th. That'll be Wednesday this week. One of those festivals that, unless it occurs on a Sunday, we hardly think about it. Well, we're going to talk about Paul the Missionary with Dr. Harold Zietlow coming up next.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
President Dean Wenthe on the future of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
In every way, I can't believe the blessings that we have been given, as we Lutherans say, not with any merit or worthiness on our part, but by God's grace, he continues to lead talented, dedicated men and women to give their lives to him and to the truth of the gospel. And I'd like to invite any of your listeners to come and visit us, but more than visit, worship with us, be my guest for a campus tour, and see how our life revolves around this wonderful truth that the incarnate Christ has brought to our world.
To accept Dr. Wenthe's invitation for an on-campus tour at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call 1-800-481-2155.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Terry Phillips, sitting in for Bob Dittmer.
The Department of Justice is preparing to defend its Child Online Protection Act in court, and it's asking Internet search engines to help. Most are, but the largest search engine on the web, Google, is resisting. They say they are protecting privacy, but Internet safety advocates say they are protecting their profits. Steve Jordahl reports.
The Child Online Protection Act is the cornerstone of the government's effort to curb porn on the Internet. Daniel Weiss of Focus on the Family Action.
This was a law passed in 1998 that required all commercial pornographers to use age verification systems before showing their products.
The Justice Department confirms that MSN, Yahoo, and AOL have all cooperated. Google is refusing. Perry Aftab of Wired Safety agrees with them.
I really think it's a good idea to have the courts review this to make sure that the privacy of individuals is protected and balanced against the need for the Department of Justice to know.
But DOJ spokesman Charles Miller says the government is not seeking and will not accept the name of individuals who have linked to porn sites. Weiss says without Google, the government's case is much weaker.
The ACLU can claim that the information the Justice Department collected is invalid because it's not complete.
Google did not return our calls for comment, but Rick Schatz of the National Coalition for the Protection of Children and Families says they're profiting from the porn industry.
Either royalties or fees in some way for the number of customers they have, the value of the advertising that they have, the number of sites that they have.
The DOJ is taking Google to court for the information. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
A judge is expected to rule by March whether or not Google can hold back those records. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Joni Harwell and me, Diane Summers. We'll visit with Turner Stimson about a different approach to Alzheimer's care. And Carol Bungie, who's clinical coordinator for the palliative care program at Unity Health Home Care, will be our guest. She'll help us understand the difference between palliative care, hospice, and other inpatient programs. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Here's what Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Angus Manoj has to say about our Book of the Month for January. Quote, "For C.S. Lewis, true education is a way to free our thinking from the spirit of the age and to humble our ego to objective truth," unquote. The book is titled Irrigating Deserts, C.S. Lewis on Education. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Irrigating Deserts.
Ken Sherb for Todd Wilkin on Issues Etc. Delighted to be with you live this Monday, January 23rd. Todd is still on vacation. He will be back here behind the mic this coming Thursday. And even before Thursday, coming up on Wednesday, is the Festival of the Conversion of St. Paul. It's one of those festivals that perhaps we overlook to our detriment, because when Jesus converted Paul, he was indeed converting, as he said, a mighty instrument to take his name to all the nations. To talk with us a bit about the subject of St. Paul, his person, his missionary techniques, and his missionary effectiveness in the ancient world, we have Dr. Harold Zietlow, Emeritus Professor of Pastoral Theology and Missions at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, my former professor. Dr. Zietlow, good to talk to you.
Good to hear from you.
True or false, Paul's the greatest missionary of the first century, and why?
Well, he's a great missionary, and there were others, and I'd hate to, you know, you take John and his writings, the Gospel and the Book of Revelation, and I would hate to pit one against the other. I would say that Paul is important for us in the Protestant tradition, because of the very emphasis on faith and grace.
Well, also that, important
that,
to...
You know, that we're not saved or enriched in life by any foreign source other than our relationship to God. What is the highest value of human beings? St. Paul says, faith, hope, and love. The greatest of these is love. This is the highest value that the human being can attach himself to.
Now,
there are a lot of people in the world today, you know, that emphasize the Islamic terrorists, for example, out of Islam. And, you know, and we got the war in Iraq, and you have fighting among them. But faith, hope, and love, the greatest of these is love. This is the highest human value. It's important in marriage. It's important in parent-child relationships, in the larger family with the grandparents, and so on. So faith, hope, and love, the greatest is love. And where do we get this? We get this out of St. Paul. He was able to take these are the cardinal virtues, faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love.
Now, Paul shows that love by doing these missionary journeys, which certainly are important to us in the West, because he was the one that we know the most about in the ancient church, who took the gospel in that Western trajectory, to and even beyond Rome. Talk a little bit about Paul's missionary journeys.
The Greek philosophy, of course, had the concept of the virtues. You know, Aristotle and Plato had built up a system of an ethical life, and in a Nicomachean ethics, and in that ethics were all of these virtues. Then Paul takes these and popularizes them: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. So if we only got a short time to talk, we want to see how this helped us. It helped us in first of all, it's a way of uniting people. Where is power? Power is a unity, and the greatest unity you can have. And this can help in, for example, the United States, which has a huge number of people and a lot of space and a lot of power. And this can be held by emphasis on love. It's shown in helping poor people. It's a strong witness. In the 10th chapter of Romans, you know, you have a strong witness on how do people become attached to Christianity. Somewhere they've been helped. We have missionaries go out to New Guinea, for example, and to Africa and all over the world. And they show love to people. They show relief to them. Very important is education. Look at the Muslim nations. You don't see the level of education or economic achievement. Look at the Christian nations, the great universities. We're talking about the Reformation and Germany, the great universities of Hamburg and Berlin. And I watch Berlin television. I can watch on Channel 56 here. I watch Berlin. That helps me keep up with my German. The emphasis in the Bible is also important. We learn in our seminaries Greek and Hebrew, so that we can read the Greek, the original language. We know what those deep words mean. We know, for example, there are two forms of love, agape and eros and philia, three forms, philia, the relationship with our friends, the erotic relationship and husband and wife, and the unselfish agape relationship, which sends us out. What's the symbol of the Red Cross? Christ died on the cross. The greatest symbol of helping people in the world is the Red Cross. When they had those on the hospitals, our bombers weren't supposed to drop bombs on them. And the trucks that were running along the fields, like in Hemingway's writings in Italy and throughout Spain, these were trucks with a Red Cross on them. So you have so many evidences of where would you want to live? Why do so many people want to pile in, even illegal immigrants, in the United States? The people who emphasize the Bible here have a work ethic. And this Protestant work ethic has built up a lot of economic and financial achievements. The other people want to come in here because of all the values, legal and illegal, to come in here and share in all of the benefits of in a Reformation. We lived 12 months in Germany. We traveled all over Germany, to all the places where Martin Luther had been. And we could see you had the trouble with communism at that time. There was Ost und West Deutschland. And we were living in the West Germany, and then we'd travel every weekend into East Germany. And we saw how wonderful Christianity was helping the people under communism. That's why I kept going in there every weekend. And for weeks we traveled in there. And they love us. We went then in a church and worshiped on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation in the church where Luther preached. And you know those communists, what they did? It was very precious. They, you know, there was poverty there in East Germany. You know what they did? They gave oranges to each of us. We had the five little children. And those communists were so impressed that we came there. They loved us. That touched their hearts. They gave them oranges, and were those precious. And I saw this. They took me and showed me secretively where the golden chalice was that Martin Luther had used, where that's hid. I photographed it, where that's hid in a rock wall back of stones. And so those little things are so precious. And this emphasis on love, on grace, and our faith relationship to God.
So you're saying that Paul, in effect, had a tremendous effect, not only on people in terms of their eternal relationship with God, but also in terms of their cultural situation in the world.
Well, it's the highest ideal that we can attach ourselves to. It's the most powerful thing that can hold a nation like the United States together.
Well,
and
thank
interpersonal
you.
Relationships and husband and wife. Husbands, love your wives. Wives, love your husbands, as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her.
Dr. Harold Zietlow, associate or professor emeritus of practical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, thank you for being with us to talk about St. Paul and the subject of missions, his impact that just went out in so many different directions. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the whole idea of Paul and his contribution to the world and certainly to Christianity as we prepare for the celebration of the conversion of St. Paul this coming Wednesday. I'm Ken Sherb for the vacationing Todd Wilkin. Our telephone number is 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Now joining us to talk about St. Paul and the subject of preaching is Dr. Carl Fekincher, also from Fort Wayne, from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne. Dr. Fekincher is professor of preaching. Carl, good afternoon.
How you doing, Ken? Good to talk with you.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I started with Dr. Zietlow asking about whether Paul was sort of the greatest missionary of the first century, and of course he said, oh, I don't want to play one apostle off against another, and that's wise. But if I were to ask you, was Paul the greatest preacher of the first century, what would you say?
Well, I think there's a strong case you can make for that, and the advantage we have when we talk about Paul is that we have not only the evidence of his sermons in the book of Acts, which of course we also have with Peter, but we have so many of his writings in the epistles that basically were written to be read in congregations. So essentially, they are a kind of a sermon in Paul's original intent. And they do read very, very powerfully, and therefore also form the basis for great preaching texts for us today. I think that without question, Paul has given us a magnificent model in his preaching, again, both in Acts and his epistles, for us, particularly in his sensitivity to audiences and how he was able to adjust his formatting for the particular different groups that he spoke to.
Well, certainly an epistle like, either 1st or 2nd Corinthians is a very different thing from the epistle to the Philippians.
Absolutely. And not just the matter of the setting in which he wrote it, but 1st Corinthians is a great example. I appreciate 1st Corinthians particularly because it shows Paul as a man who really understood how he could make connection with the Greek mind. Now, Paul, of course, was Jewish, and he was tutored in Jerusalem, but he also, growing up in Tarsus and then working in the Greek world for most of his missionary ministry, understood the way the Greeks thought. The Palestinian Jew, for example, the Jews living in Jerusalem, were very strongly what we would say these days Asian in their mindset, and that is borne out nicely in the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures, where very often the way a literary piece was arranged was in a kind of circular motion, or also in very small wisdom sayings, like in the book of Proverbs. But the Greeks were a very different kind of mindset. The Greeks would think in a much more linear kind of way. The kind of arrangement of logic that is actually quite comfortable to us today. For example, we're very comfortable having someone lay out a proposition and say, now, for the next hour, we're going to talk about this. If it's going to be an interview on issues, et cetera, we announce to the audience that this is going to be the subject for the day. And then one would expect that for the next 60 minutes, the interview will follow that basic, fairly direct kind of pattern, where one thought leads to another, but always on that one major subject. This is the way the Greeks thought, and so this is the way Paul structures, for example, the first letter to the Corinthians. When he writes 1 Corinthians, time and again, he begins by saying something like, now concerning spiritual gifts, brethren, or when he talks about a man living with his father's wife, he says, it is reported among you that there is ungodliness, unlike even among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife, and then he'll develop that. Or when he talks about issues with the Lord's Supper, he'll introduce the subject and he'll stick to that subject throughout one or two or three chapters as they've been divided for us. That's a very Western, or we might say Occidental or Greek kind of pattern of thinking that is quite comfortable for us. And Paul, being a Jew and living in Jerusalem and being tutored by the rabbis there, is really impressive in his ability to work now in that kind of Greek pattern of thinking so that his readers in Corinth will understand exactly how one thought leads to another, grouped around a theme statement, a subject line.
Paul knew his audience, his readers. Actually, audience is probably the more appropriate term because the letter would have been read aloud
right.
to
That's
them.
Right.
He knew his audience well, both in terms of knowing, for example, the Corinthians. He had met them. He had worked among them for a year and a half. He could probably imagine some of their faces
right.
as the letter was being written.
Right.
But at the same time, Paul also gives great evidence of knowing the broader culture in which these people live. He is capable of quoting Greek poets and
right.
Greek philosophers almost at will. What does that say to you as a teacher of preaching about how preachers need to be trained in the church to this day?
Well, that's a good example, Ken. You're right. In a couple levels, take the second one first. The second one is the literature of the people with which Paul was familiar. And you, of course, cite the example of his sermon on Mars Hill in Athens, where he could quote the secular poets of the Greeks. And so for our preachers today to be aware of what people are reading, and what to broaden that to say, what they're watching and what they're hearing, is really very, very important. It's our people, our preachers, as they're learning the task, should not be afraid of going back to those novels that they learned, that they read in high school and college English classes, and they should be expanding on those. They also shouldn't think that they are above the kind of common literature of our day, and that would mean TV, movies, music, that our people are also absorbing. It's very, very helpful in preaching to be aware of those things. And then the earlier reference that you made to how Paul knew the Corinthians, for example, how he had lived and worked among them, something I certainly stress when I teach my guys preaching, is that you really can't be an effective preacher on Sunday morning unless you're also very, very much involved in the lives of your congregation throughout the week. In fact, there's an axiom of preaching that a guy who is invisible during the week will be inscrutable or incomprehensible on Sunday. People won't understand what he's talking about if he hasn't been out there finding out and understanding what they are living with during the week.
Well, those are good kind of stock pieces of advice for all preachers. However, there was at least one case where Paul had to write to a church where he didn't know the people. He hadn't been there yet. And, of course, that was the letter to the Romans.
Right. That's right. Even there, Paul shows a very nice affection for them. And it's obvious that he's had a lot of connection with them indirectly. He says that he looks forward to coming to be with them. And our tradition indicates that probably Paul had a very, very good time among them when he was imprisoned there at the end of the book of Acts. The book of Acts ends as he has arrived, but it seems that for at least the 2 years mentioned, he was there working among them. In anticipation of his coming to them, he begins basically with a very important and very broad-reaching kind of premise, and that is of the need for our justification under the gospel, the power of the gospel that is for everyone, he says. And, of course, that's a part of the premise, too, that the gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, for the Jew and for the Greek. Paul realizes here, as he speaks to people or writes to people that he has not met, that certain things are nevertheless absolutely universal to everyone. And the result is a magnificent treatise on how everyone is saved, justification by grace through faith. Paul knows that even people he has not met are under God's wrath, as he says in chapter 3 of Romans, that they've all gone their own way, that no one has done good, not even one. Paul knows that's absolutely universal. The law needs to be declared to everyone because everyone by nature is sinful, an enemy of God. And then Paul knows that the remedy for everyone, Jew, Greek, Roman, Corinthian, and so on, is always the gospel of what Christ has done on the cross, that Christ, by dying for the ungodly, has taken all of the sins of the world upon himself and now delivered that magnificent salvation to everyone who believes this gospel message. So you raise a good example there, too, where Paul does not know all of the particulars in the case of the individuals, hasn't been there, but certainly knows what is universal for their need and the solution to their need.
And what Paul lays out, of course, in Romans, maybe more visibly, ostensibly than in other places, is something that I know is near and dear to your heart, the distinction between law and gospel. But it certainly is not absent in his other work, in his other epistles. I'll just let you have carte blanche. Outside the book of Romans, here's your issues, etc. challenge question for this afternoon, Carl.
Good deal.
Outside of Romans, give me an example of Paul proclaiming law and gospel to somebody else, maybe with a particular situation in mind or a particular problem, but how does he take this theory and move it into practice?
Well, Galatians, of course, is a great example there, a magnificent example, because he's dealing with a situation where law and gospel have been very badly confused. The churches, plural, in Galatia had to come under the influence of Judaizers, that is, men who were saying that to be a member of this new Christian religion, you must first become a Jew. You must be circumcised, as God had required of his people in the Old Testament, and then keep all the various dietary laws that God had given in the Old Testament, the Sabbath laws, and all of those Old Testament laws. What the Judaizers were basically doing was saying that the gospel, what Christ has done for us by keeping the law perfectly, by dying for our failures to keep the law, had been insufficient. Certainly, they would affirm that what Jesus did was absolutely necessary, but not sufficient, not all-encompassing. So Paul has to look at this situation and say, is the law still at least part of the way to one's salvation? Christ has done a magnificent thing in dying for our sins, and now we do our part. Essentially, what Paul says in the book of Romans is, or rather the book of Galatians, is that those of you who would like to be justified by your works have fallen from grace. If you have reverted from believing that you're saved by what Christ has done, a salvation by faith in Christ, to a salvation system which is by your works, then you have thrown yourself back on the law and rejected the gospel altogether. Then you're really saying that the gospel is not the power of God to salvation, as he said to the Romans. So it's very much a law-gospel issue that Paul's addressing there. And, of course, as he goes through the book of Galatians, he comes down again and again and again, finally so clearly, so emphatically, that what Christ has done is indeed all sufficient for our salvation. He even goes back and says, why, even for Abraham. Abraham's salvation wasn't by his works. Abraham's salvation wasn't by his being circumcised. Abraham's salvation also was by faith. In the case of Abraham, it was faith in what the coming Messiah, his descendant, some generation down the line, would do. And now Paul is saying to the Galatians, you guys have the magnificent certainty that Abraham's descendant has come, that Jesus Christ has done all the things that are necessary for our salvation. And he says, if you want anything other than that, then you are foolish Galatians who have been, he says, bewitched, if you would depend on anything other than what Christ did so completely and so sufficiently.
Okay, final question, and a little bit of a challenge here, too. If you had
sure.
to give me one sentence to say what's the most important thing we should bear in mind as we get ready to celebrate the conversion of St. Paul about St. Paul as a preacher, what would it be?
I would say that God uses the most humble vessels to proclaim his eternally saving message. Paul was an enemy of Christ. He worked so hard to persecute and destroy the church. There was nothing in Paul that one could look at and say, now here's the man that is going to lead through the 2,000 years since, directly or indirectly, literally millions of people to heaven. Nothing there that you could foresee. As a man is endeavoring to become a preacher and struggling week after week with the task of preaching, he can well look at himself and say, a sinner like me, why, maybe I'm the chief of sinners. And yet, if we see ourselves as totally inadequate, we can take comfort in the fact that God used someone who was himself totally inadequate, who called himself the chief of sinners, and see that God worked his magnificent message of saving countless people through the message of Christ, in which the Holy Spirit works, yet through the humble mouthpiece of this fallen preacher.
Thank you. That's a little bit more than one sentence, you realize, but thank you very much, Carl.
You bet.
Dr. Carl Fikincher, Professor of Preaching at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, where they will be hosting several retreats coming up this spring, including one led by Dr. John Seleska, a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. He'll be talking about Christ in the Old Testament. For more information about the retreats at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, look for their logo on our homepage. That's issuesetc.org. We'll tell you more about these retreats coming up after the news, and we'll be talking about C.S. Lewis as a student with Dr. Joel Heck, continuing our series. Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.